What happened is a larger symptom that we're seeing in news organizations across the country, which is they are really struggling to cover in a way that appears to be nonpartisan, a kind of political landscape where one political party has in many ways gone rogue and is not following the rules. But there's a sense if you just cover that straight down the line, you will look like you are picking sides. And so this adherence to even-handedness, both-sidism, the view from nowhere, doesn't actually work in the political circumstances that we're in.
That was Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times Magazine correspondent Nicole Hannah-Jones, famous for ringleading the paper's controversial and fact-challenged 1619 Project, discussing on CNN's Reliable Sources this weekend the frankly bizarre series of events that led the paper of record parting ways with its previously well-regarded opinion editor, James Bennett, over his decision to publish a controversial and fact-challenged op-ed by Republican U.S. Senator Tom Cotton. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I'm Matt Welch, joined by my fellow non-unionized colleagues, Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangyu Ward. Welcome to the struggle session, comrades.
Howdy.
Hi, Matt.
Hi.
Let's see if I can condense this in less than 17 minutes. A story that manages to be both laughably trivial and I think also deeply symbolic of where the political and journalistic culture is heading. So on Wednesday night, the New York Times opinion page did what elite media opinion pages have been doing for the last half century, which is publish an advocacy column by a person in power. In this case, the person was the reliably anti-libertarian Tom Cotton, and the advocacy was for President Donald Trump using the 1807 Insurrection Act to put down looting in cities that couldn't control it. The piece carried the provocative headline, Send in the Troops. On Thursday, the union that represents New York Times employees called the publication of Cotton's piece a, quote, clear threat to the health and safety of journalists, arguing that his message undermines the journalistic work of our members, puts our black staff members in danger, promotes hate, and is likely to encourage further violence. Dozens of staffers, led by the aforementioned Nicole Hannah-Jones, took to Twitter to allege that Cotton's piece endangers the lives of black journalists at the New York Times. Also on Thursday, the perennially controversial opinion editor Barry Weiss published a short Twitter feed placing the flap in the context of a generational divide at the paper between the younger wokes and the older kind of more civil libertarian types, for which she was instantly flayed rhetorically in public by her own colleagues. Friday brought a staff walkout, an all hands on deck staff meeting, ritual apologetics from editor James Bennett and the publisher A.G. Sulzberger, and a new 300-word editor's note on top of Cotton's op-ed saying that the essay fell short of our standards and should not have been published. This was obviously never going to be enough. And so by Sunday, the paper parted ways with Bennett and also kicked his deputy off of the masthead and into the re-education camps in the newsroom. Sulzberger insisted, quote, that none of these changes mark a retreat from the Times' responsibility to help people understand a range of voices across the breadth of public debate, which I am sure at least somebody believes. This pattern, including the kind of defenestrations across the media landscape, is happening everywhere in this past very remarkable week of protest and ferment and weirdness in American life, which we'll get to later. But first, I don't want to lose sight of the underlying message of Cotton's op-ed, however increasingly irrelevant it might be at this point. So, Catherine Mangyu Ward, you edit a magazine of opinion called Reason that's libertarian. Is it a good idea to use the 1807 Insurrection Act to put down looting in America's cities?
Boy, howdy, it is not. That is not a good idea. That is what I would describe as an objectively bad idea. It's a non-good idea. The op-ed itself is actually this sort of very interesting two-step. Even the framing that the Times put on it, I suppose, is sort of nods to this. It says, send in the troops as the head. In Tom Cotton's voice. But then the subhead is the nation must restore order. The military stands ready. And I actually think that tells you a lot about what's about to happen in this op-ed, because it's the argument boils down to things don't seem great we have a really, really big military. And that has been the argument for doing a lot of terrible, useless things for so long. So many times in the last decades, we have basically said, well, we've got this military. I guess we should deploy it. And this is just the last thing in a long line. The, of course, important difference is that in this case, we were talking about deploying it against American citizens, which has an extra bad layer on it. Both for practical reasons, the U.S. military is not trained or equipped to be deployed domestically, and that is not what they're built to do. But also, it's bad because there's going to be a massive, ridiculous constitutional debate that will follow. And I hope that in the end, we don't have the Insurrection Act to grapple with anymore. But, it is there. I do think it's probably legal, the thing that he's suggesting, which is maybe worth talking about. It's just a horrifically bad idea.
Peter, you live in Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C. has a different arrangement with the federal government than the rest of the country does. And as such, has had a different response to protesting and looting. I don't know to what extent there's been looting in Washington, D.C., but certainly there's been some. Can you put this idea about the Insurrection Act in the context of sort of witnessing either through the eyes of friends or through the people who work at Reason who have experienced the way that the military has been deployed in the District of Columbia over the past week to 10 days?
So we had several thousand National Guard troops deployed to the area, some of which were out and about. And then Trump has also in the past day or so agreed to draw down the military presence in the District of Columbia, basically saying, well, everything, I think the quote is something like everything's perfect now. Yeah, sorry. Now that everything is under perfect control, which, you know, thank you, Donald Trump, obviously. No, the military has, if anything, caused a lot of confusion and complication because there is this kind of split rule that exists in the District of Columbia that doesn't exist anywhere else, where the president does have the ability to move law, military force into the city, which then comes into conflict with local police. And then you also have the sort of added issue, which is that a bunch of the forces that have been moved in that in order to deal with the riots in particular, which there were, I won't say it was not city level destruction, but it was pretty bad on Sunday and Monday night of the previous week. And the forces that were called in were from what is referred to in Washington as the alphabet soup of agencies. Just a ton of different law enforcement agencies, of federal agencies that have armed agents at their disposal. And many of those folks, it's sort of not clear who they are when you see them on the street. In some cases, there were armed people walking around, clearly official in some capacity, that were not in any way designated. You couldn't figure out who they worked for or who was in control of them. And it was a big problem because in addition to just sort of having a conflict between protesters, many of whom were protesting peacefully, and between, law enforcement people, you then had this sort of further confusion about who was in charge and what was going on. I think an important point to make here is that this isn't just a bad idea. It isn't just sort of a dubiously constitutional idea, what Tom Cotton was calling for. It is one that the military has resisted. And the New York Times did a useful report in the last day or so, noting that General Mark A. Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Barr, the attorney general, had to argue Trump out of using the Insurrection Act and using the military to quell unrest in cities. And it was the military, along with Bob Barr, of all people, who said this is a bad idea. And in particular, Milley noted, you know, look, we took an oath to the Constitution. This would at least raise big constitutional questions. And Americans, he said, you know, the Constitution gives Americans the right to freedom of speech and peaceful assembly. The military doesn't want to be part of this. They don't want to be on American city streets. And that was something that Trump was pushing over their objections.
Nick, let's recenter the conversation back to the
happy back to, to How are your chakras?
Not God. Great.
Well, we're dropping some like Woody Allen 1978 here. Let's get back to the New York Times, since that's what all journalists.
It's the only thing that matters.
All journalists are talking about, and all non-journalists haven't heard of. Is this thing. There are commentators, Margaret Sullivan at the Washington Post among them, who are saying, looking at what's happening at the Times and elsewhere, and we were going to get to the elsewhere here in a bit, and they see what they consider to be kind of perhaps a potentially healthy process going on in the fields of journalism. I look at this and I see mostly a lot of mob hysterics and a retreat from certain previous commitments. What do you see?
I try to look away, and it's actually pretty easy, Matt, because just as I think the standard libertarian line, which I take some issue with, when it comes to Facebook or Twitter or whoever deplatforming people, why shouldn't the New York Times deplatform everybody who the 10 or 12 people there who actually exert power disagree with? So let them get rid of all of this kind of stuff. You know, who cares? I say that as somebody who was published in the New York Times op-ed page, who looks forward to being published again in the New York Times op-ed page. And in a certain way, this exactly shows what a world of ideological purity is going to look like. And when organizations like the New York Times, which does not profess to be an ideological vantage point, but a more broad-based platform for open discussion, free expression, and inquiry into all sorts of ideas, when they start acting like, you know, cultural revolutionaries in Mao's China, this is what you can expect. And it's a big problem, but it's not, you know, to me, it's not an existential one. Ben Smith, formerly of BuzzFeed, who joined the Times recently or a couple months ago as a media reporter, had a really interesting story that went up today about kind of mostly black writers who emerged from activist backgrounds, mostly out of Ferguson, and the kind of coverage they were doing. In that story, he talked about how the Times monetary base and journalism, daily newspaper journalism's basic financial model has shifted over the past decade and is continuing to, from one that where advertisers basically subsidize the price of everything to where subscribers pay directly for what they're doing. Expect to see more of this. This is totally reflective of that shift. The Times is betting that their subscribers want ideological rigidity and they don't want to be bothered by anything else. So that's where this is heading.
Catherine, I see in the broader Nicole Hannah-Jones clip, or even the one that we listened to, she's rejecting both sidesism and the view from nowhere. These are kind of things that have emerged from the meta-journalistic conversations. People like Jay Rosen and Jeff Jarvis, professors of journalism in New York, have talked about. But also in the broader clip that we didn't listen to, she just absolutely factually mischaracterized Tom Cotton's piece, saying that he was arguing for using the military to quash dissent. That might be a knock-on effect of what would happen should his desire come true, but he had language to the direct contrary in the piece itself. And I note also that the Times's tweet about its own personnel decisions included a similar factual inaccuracy, which is pointed out by Tom Cotton. And then they corrected their piece that also continued the factual inaccuracy without really mentioning that they had changed the language. They didn't append any kind of correction to the fact that they got it wrong. I say all of this as a throat clear of on day like or in the 36th hour of this, the critique of Tom Cotton's piece went from, oh, this is endangering the lives of people, to, oh, it just didn't meet the factual standards. Do you see an even application of factual standards emanating from the post both sidesism New York Times?
No, I do not. I guess I just want to start, though, by saying it's perfectly fine if what the New York Times decides it's going to do is run an op-ed page with clear and consistent ideological slant, right? And this is something that we've talked about on this podcast in many, many different platform contexts. The New York Times is a privately run newspaper, and if they want to do what many others have already done, including Reason Magazine, and have a clear point of view that they sometimes used to determine what content they're going to run, even from outside writers, they are more than welcome to do that. So I do just want to be super clear about that, that there is not some public square, public utility, civic duty that the Times uniquely has in its role of paper of record to publish garbage by Tom Cotton. However, I think that this particular Tom Cotton garbage was really important and informative about what's going on in our country. It is exactly the sort of thing that the op-ed page in its currently constituted form at the New York Times professes to do, which is to bring together a bunch of different voices to try and understand important conversations about politics and policy and culture in the United States. So, I think there is a version of the New York Times, which, as Nick noted, is more likely to occur if the Times is focusing on their subscribers, who typically lean left, although their subscriber base is also very, very large and so contains multitudes.
I think if
you just bank on the sheer geographical distribution of Times subscribers, you can assume that they are at the very least Democratic voters in majority. But the idea that not all journalism has to be objective and both sidesism obviously is something we embrace at Reason Magazine. We don't do that type of journalism. We do a journalism that is inflected with our ideas. But one thing that we do work really, really hard to do is to be factually accurate and to be fair, that we want to give people who we disagree with their own words to explain their point of view, and we want to present those words fairly. That's why I think it's interesting that they couldn't even tweet about this op-ed in an accurate way. They were not according their op-ed contributor the sort of etiquette of fairness and accuracy that we would like to see. But yeah, clearly the idea that there was somehow a factual error somewhere in that piece that they won't say what it was as the reason that they are now backing away from it and firing people for publishing it, like, that's a bunch of hooey and is just cover for the fact that people really, really, really didn't like that op-ed and the decision to publish it.
Can we talk about the view from nowhere specifically? I think it's actually really important. Yes. Here. So if you go back to about 2003, press sort of critic, thinker, Jay Rosen coined this phrase, the view from nowhere, which he has described as a bid to advertise of the viewlessness of the person who is producing the news. It is a form of defensive journalism, he has said, that pretends to an impartiality in an attempt to secure the legitimacy of the news producer. That's both the reporter and the institution. And this moment is in many ways the culmination, I think, of the view from nowhere and its sort of movement through newsrooms in America. The view from nowhere had some real truth to it. It was a useful critique of turn of the century, turn of the millennium journalism. It got at the ways that journalism could be mealy-mouthed, timid, unhelpful in its attempts to be nonpartisan and impartial. But the problem with that, with the critique, was that it was also kind of partisan or at least ideological. There was an undercurrent to it that sort of leaned left because it said that in many cases, there wasn't some amount of truth on both sides. Instead, on a lot of issues, one faction had a monopoly on truth, and that faction was always the left. It was always the Democratic Party, and that's why you saw left-leaning journalists pick up the view from nowhere sort of as a rallying cry. And so a particular example on this, not the only one, but one that gets talked about a lot, was on global warming. And sort of we all know how that argument played out in the press over the last 20 years or so, where it's like, no, there's not both sides. The Republicans are simply wrong on this. The Democrats are simply right. And journalists who are writing factual news stories should say so. And we could, instead of going down that rabbit hole, we'll just understand that that's part of this. So the view from nowhere criticism, I think, began as something useful, a critique of kind of fake nonpartisan journalism that wasn't helpful to readers. But in the end, it kind of ended up being a way of smuggling in a more overtly liberal sensibility, not just into the op-ed pages, but into the news pages themselves. That happened in part with the move of journalism online. So this, like I said, was a a big item of discussion in the aughts when journalism was really going from paper to digital. It gave rise to, among other things, the fact checker movement, which has been fact checked in some cases, right? But which has been an object of discussion, and sort of there's been a lot of critique of, oh, this is, it's, they're not actually just impartially checking facts. What they're doing is sort of enforcing a liberal view of what the facts are. And then more recently, as Nick mentioned, as the ad market has collapsed and journalism has become more reliant on passionate readers who pay for subscriptions, journalism has had an incentive to drop the pretense of impartiality, which won them sources on both the left and right, and kept advertisers happy, because advertisers are often scared of overtly strongly partisan or strongly ideological journalism. And so what it ended up doing in the end is kind of repeating in a different form the old impartiality fallacy, but in a different way. Because what the View from Nowhere critique sort of has led to is saying, well, there is only one truth, and it's just the truth, right? That's what Hannah Jones was talking about, you know, at the beginning. And that truth is a largely left and progressive way of looking at the world. And that's not bias. It's just science. It's just fact. It's truth with a capital T. And so, again, you know, I think this critique started out in a good place and was useful, but it has ended up being a way of just sort of smuggling a left viewpoint into journalism that pretends to not have one.
Nick, I want to build on that point and bring the coronavirus in it, because the coronavirus is actually in everything.
I don't have the corona. I had the coronavirus, Matt. I have antibodies to the coronavirus, both, you know, epidemiologically and ideologically.
I wasn't trying to out you virologically.
No, I'm clean as a whistle.
No, being dirty. Talking about the kind of View from Nowhere, the capital S science and truth, if you were to transport yourself to 3 weeks ago or 4 weeks ago, if people were using the View from Nowhere as an epithet to describe, you know, people's mangling of truth or you know, journalistic both sidesism that is preventing us from getting to the actual truth, it would have probably been used against protesters who were protesting the lockdowns. And
The media was livid that these fat, dumb, mullet wearing, you know, machine gun wielding lard asses in Michigan were marching on, you know, the Capitol in order to buy seeds at Home Depot.
And yet,
mullets are back in, guys. I mean, we all are now, like, we have legally enforced mullets here.
I know you're planning to write on this later at Reason.com. Great, great website. Talk a little.
You know, I find it a little narrow ideologically.
Yeah, you know.
Not enough Tom Cotton.
I can't believe that people who consider themselves to be smart are coming at me and us and saying, well, why don't you publish Tom Cotton as a response to all this? Anyways, put that aside. Talk a little bit about how the journalistic and also, like, epidemiologist sudden enthusiasm for protests places these kind of capital T truth arguments and also the kind of trust that it disengenders.
Well, I really don't even understand what you're saying, Matt, but I'm calling 911 because I think you might be having a mini stroke. Yeah. I mean, do you want some Green Goddess salad dressing with that word salad?
I just need to hydrate, but go on.
Yeah. Okay. Now, hydration is good, but hyperhydration is problematic. You know, what we have been witnessing, you know, for all of my lifetime, which is all I can kind of lay claim to knowing at all, is, you know, a retreat from truth with a capital T to, I think, both an understanding and an appreciation, you know, and this is postmodernism 101, that, you know, meta-narratives are, you know, most of the time they're horseshit or they are hypotheses. They're not actual revealed truth. They oftentimes mask wills to power and things like that. And what we are witnessing across every aspect of our lives, whether it's science or religion or culture or politics or ideology, is that our sources are lying to us even when they are acting in good faith, but especially when they're acting in bad faith. And I think that's one of the things that is being conjured by this Times op-ed scenario, because all of the people who are attacking Tom Cotton, they're acting generally in bad faith. They're you know, they don't want Tom Cotton in their pages, and they are able to flex now for a variety of internal reasons to the Times and get their way, and they're going to push that all the way, you know, off the cliff. More power to them. You know, an interesting question is to ask, like, why do we still have op-ed pages in an age of self-publishing? I, for one, would be happy to see the Times turn everything into some form of, you know, deeply embedded ideological journalism, where the people are talking openly about their priors and their assumptions and are just admitting, this is my version of the truth. Take it, you know, pay for it or not, read it or not. That's all good. With the coronavirus stuff, Matt, you know, one of the things that has been hilarious, and a number of people at Reason have written about this, I think, to good effect, you know, that was one of the last redoubts where we had people who were saying, no, you know, I'm a scientist with a capital S and I tell capital truth T's, and God damn it, you fat slobs from the Midwest, stay home. Don't even be, you know, socially isolated in your own house, in your McMansion, which is destroying the planet, blah, blah, blah. And then 2 days later, they're like, oh, you know what? It's actually, it's a good thing. It might even help bring herd immunity by having thousands of people, you know, marching in close quarters for a cause I consider good. You know, this is the Trump era. We, you know, Lord knows, I'm against almost everything that Trump has done. The ushering in of massive unrestrained spending, which we have no idea how that's going to end up, you know, screwing over not only our future, but our kids' future. It's a clarifying moment. It's a revelatory moment. It's not just Trump. It's everyone.
I can tell you how it's going to end up here is that we're going to just keep doing more.
Yeah,
of it.
Yeah. And maybe as long as you don't stop, you know, as long as you keep passing it on to the next person, everything goes good. But what I'm saying is it's we're just everything is being revealed in its worst possible way, which is that people are kind of horseshit artists. And I would like to get to a place where we are actually arguing more in good faith rather than bad faith, because I think that's what we're seeing now is, you know, epidemiologists who are saying, no, you know, like, it's okay to protest. It's okay to protest. People like Nicholas Christakis, the Yale professor who has been through the barrel a couple of times, an epidemiologist, are talking about that. He says, you know, like, we can say scientifically this is not good from an epidemiological point of view, but it's happening. That's a good faith argument. And there are still good faith people. I think that's where we need to be getting. And to go back to what Catherine was saying about Reason, the, you know, one of the unique selling propositions of Reason, and it's getting more unique in the media environment, is that we do our best to represent the best arguments against our points of view. We don't shroud our points of view in fake claims to objectivity, but we also don't try to only, you know, pick the Tom Cottons of the world when we want to engage people we disagree with. I want to see that become the social norm. That's what we need to be modeling, I think, in media, but in other aspects of our lives as well.
Catherine, Robbie Suave had a piece on the site today talking about the use of, and this is a word that's used pejoratively by Robbie and people like Jonathan Haidt and Greg Lukianoff, of a safety-ism, cloaking disagreements in over or hyperbolic concerns for the safety of people who are receiving somebody else's opinion. Hold that thought for in one, and the other related thing that I will say is that, as I've mentioned probably before, I used to think that some of the libertarian concern over what the ridiculous kind of things that were happening on college campuses was kind of in its own way not self-serving, but just like it was overheated about the effects. So do you think that this kind of a controversy, like, definitively shows that the virus has leapt from college campus to the institutions?
So college campus as wet market? Matt, as wet market?
Catherine gets to do it. You don't.
Didn't you just complain about calling things viruses that weren't viruses?
No, I complained about calling them epidemics. I complained about calling it an epidemic.
Also,
something that's not an epidemic during an epidemic.
Don't discriminate against charge. Matt for his disability, okay? Matt struggles, And we need to be kind to him.
Thank you. And my safety is...
It's hard to remember that when you don't go into the office and see the posters on the wall.
Oh.
That is true. Use this as an opportunity, Catherine, to defend Reason's interest in Robbie Suave's beat and apply it to what we've been talking
about. Yeah, I mean, I do think that the events, particularly in the media industry of the last few weeks, have pretty definitively put a bow on the virus box that is the buried treasure of the 1990s, which has blossomed into a beautiful tree of workplace safety violations. So, yes, basically...
I understood all of that.
I don't feel safe anymore.
I don't know why, but... workplace safety violation. Yeah. No, I mean, there, I think, were people who... in good faith said, hey, listen, there are a lot of really, really bad things going on in the world, really bad things for the case, for the cause of free minds and free markets. And why do you guys keep writing about a bunch of dumb 18-year-olds being dumb on their college campuses? Hey, your emphasis is misplaced. And you know what? I think those people were wrong, because all those 18-year-olds grew up and went out into the workplace and did not leave behind the most sort of precious version of safetyism, as it is sometimes called, of political correctness, as it was once called, and instead brought it with them in full force to the workplace. And it is now playing out in a very concrete way, not just in the media industry, but everywhere. I mean, the way that every corporation in America has attempted to handle the kind of cultural echoes from the protests, from the Black Lives Matter protests, from the anti-police brutality protests, has been a study in safetyism. Now, there's some good effects, right? In fact, there are a bunch of corporations that probably have historically been insufficiently sensitive to a bunch of unique needs and desires for their Black employees, for instance. It's good. They should take a minute to think about that. But the safetyism in the workplace thing has shown itself dramatically. It is on the rise. That originated in college campuses, and focusing on that was indeed a correct thing to do in order to look into the future. At the same time, I am really struck by the fact that we are nationally right now, we are rallying around this concern, a concern that I share and that Reason has shared for more than 50 years, that people are not safe from the police, that like many people, but especially Black people, are physically unsafe, in danger, because of the way that we have structured policing in this country. And what's more, that Tom Cotton and others like him now want to bring into that already volatile mix the U.S. Armed Forces, from whom we would not be safe because they have a mandate to use force to restore order if they were to be brought in this way that Tom Cotton wants them to be brought in. There is a real, genuine fear about physical safety of people in this country. And it's bizarre to me that we are using the same language to talk about words, to talk about points of view that make people uncomfortable or that they don't like. We should be so careful not to use the same language, not least because it minimizes the very, very real threat to the physical safety of particularly Black men from the police.
Let's also focus, though, you know, where Tom Cotton is most dangerous is in his harebrained yet statistically popular idea about bringing in troops to help keep order in cities. You know, polls show that a majority of Americans and a near majority of Democrats and Blacks actually support that. That's not where he's influential. He is influential in policing speech and, you know, trying to minimize Section 230 protections, to kind of, you know, dampen the ability of websites to actually use user-generated comment, to have free expression. And he's precisely influential there because there are tons of people who are supposedly his ideological other in the Democratic Party, liberals versus conservatives. There's so many people in Congress right now who want to destroy Section 230, who want to narrow what the internet is allowed to talk about without fear of lawsuits and all sorts of legal protections. To my mind, that's one of the places that we need to be focusing on far more than his stupid op-ed in the New York Times. And it's not an either or. But what I'm saying is that, the problem of the young woke people at the New York Times and other media organizations, where they're using whatever club is handy to beat their old bosses into submission or out the door. That's bad. Culturally and legally, we have a problem where liberals and conservatives, ostensibly, sworn enemies, they are both working in the same way to screw up the internet as we know it by limiting free expression. And that's where I think we need to be focusing the conversation and the discussion, because if they do weaken Section 230, if they do, in the name of opposing one another, end up limiting free speech, we're really screwed.
I do want to say, just, I guess, one more time for the kids in the back, the New York Times not running a Tom Cotton op-ed is not censorship. The thing that Tom Cotton would potentially like to do, using the force of the state to restrict speech, that is censorship.
Yes.
And it's exactly what Elizabeth Warren, and a bunch of other progressive lefties have been talking about nonstop. Joe Biden hates 230. He hates a free and open internet.
I think a way that I'm increasingly looking at this is that there has been, over the past 4 to 5 years, most sharply, but generally and increasing by the day, a openly anti-enlightenment crusade on both left and right. I won't say it's equal, because nothing's equal in this world, but the Adrian Vermeules of the world are nattering on like, the Enlightenment sucks. Peter Thiel thinks the Enlightenment is overhyped. The 1619 Project itself is a way to try to repudiate on some levels, or to call the hypocrisy of 1776, which is, the Declaration of Independence is arguably one of the greatest Enlightenment documents. So I'm going to, just read one more quote, because it's kind of crazy, came across my Twitter feed. This is from a New York Times editor saying to staff, anyone who sees any piece of opinion journalism, headlines, social posts, photos, you name it, that gives you the slightest pause, please call or text me immediately. So that's going to end super well. Before we leave this topic, and since a lot of the New York Times anxiety is expressed or refracted through its semi-leaked Slack channels, I want to continue my habit of exposing Peter Suderman's slacking by Peter, you were a little anguished about all this stuff last night. You were kind of feeling dark about this. Do you want to talk about your dark feelings about these trends in American life?
What I want to talk about is your Slack, in which you said, not quite an exact quote, but in which
you
said,
"Don't you guys have dirty underwear you can talk about?" I mean, where does it stop?
Look, when we bring back the video option, dirty underwear is going to be the only thing that we're talking about.
Right.
Matt, in which you said that virtually all the righties associated with the New York Times opinion page are looking to leave. To skedaddle, I believe, is the word you used.
Yeah.
Spill the tea, man.
Are they going to get a ride from Esther Williams and Corn Pop?
I hope so.
They're going to go Gandhi dance. Yes, Peter? Yeah. Come on.
So who's looking to skedaddle? What's the spill the tea?
Wow. Yeah. First of all, we have to commend Peter for his correct use of spill the tea. Nice work. Second, I love how you just absolutely escalated that. If you're going to quote my Slack, I'm going to quote yours. Like, that was hardcore. That was definitely much more of an off the record Matt Welsh comment. But go ahead, Matt, you deal with it.
Yeah, I mean, I usually, factual stuff is, I would think, off the record more than personal feelings.
I responded by quoting that, because look, there are all sorts of rumors going around in journalism right now, because look, as Nick said, in one way, this is like a total sideshow. It's just this little inside baseball thing that actually only concerns a relatively small number of people employed in journalism, mostly in New York and Washington and a little bit in LA. But in fact, it's behind closed doors, this is the only thing that journalists talked about for the last 3 days. And they talked about it in relation to the protests. They talked about it in relation to police violence. They talked about it in relation to Black Lives Matter, to the sort of the overall changes in journalism, to the way that the coronavirus has destroyed a lot of business models. I mean, The Atlantic laid off nearly 70 people. And a big reason why the Atlantic did that was because they were getting a huge amount of revenue from their events business, which doesn't exist in the world of coronavirus. So I brought up your quote in part to turn it back on you, but because I think it's actually useful as a way of describing how people are feeling. And people are feeling like this is a moment of instability and like it's unclear where journalism as a profession is going to land after this and what's going to happen, not just because of the very basic business side pressures that we have all been faced with starting 20 years ago when journalism moved online and a lot of the ad revenue from print dried up and the monopolies that a lot of local papers had went away and all of the kind of the back of the paper advertising that paid for a lot of journalism went away. But, you know, the last 20 years of pressures are now coming to a head in a lot of ways. And it is having both business and journalistic, ethic, ideological effects on the way that journalism, particularly journalism in Washington, D.C. and New York, but not only. I mean, there were issues with
certainly not only
there were issues at the Philadelphia Inquirer this weekend over a headline. And it's just really feels
insane. That you would cashier an editor in chief of a newspaper who has produced an enormous amount of good stuff.
Editor of Variety
was put on
a hiatus for a couple of weeks, right? So this has been going on everywhere. And I will just say that for many journalists, regardless of your ideological outlook, regardless of your sort of stability, your position in the world, it just feels like an odd time in which it's hard to predict where things are going to land. It feels like a time of instability and where the direction of things, both business and ideological or content production, is really kind of uncertain and unclear. And I will say that if there is an exception to that, as to me, it is at places. It is at Reason specifically and places like Reason generally, where I actually feel like we know what our mission is. We are doing it. We are producing the kinds of stuff that we are built to produce. And we don't, I don't feel like there's that sort of uncertainty and instability or confusion here. And that's, a credit to the institution in a lot of ways. But that's not the case in a lot of other publications.
This past week has been remarkable. If you're a subscriber to, for instance, Brian Stelter's CNN Reliable Sources newsletter, which comes in daily, there have been scores, not just like a handful, but scores of instances in this past week. Because if you recall, last Tuesday, I believe, was sort of a national day of show your support for Black Lives Matter on your Instagram account by like posting a big black square or something like that. There's been a lot of institutional pressure. There's an op-ed in the New York Times saying that if your loved ones don't demonstrate in public at anti-racism protests or give money to like Black Lives Matter or affiliated organizations, you should cut ties with them, at least temporarily. So this, what people have done over and over again, Peter, you mentioned the Philadelphia Inquirer editor, Stan Wisknowski. The headline was Buildings Matter Too, and it was over an op-ed. Right. So like it's an expression of opinion and led to him being cashiered. The Variety editor, Claudia Eller. And this is the pattern that most interests and kind of alarms me, because we saw this a lot and we will continue to see this over the coming days, where you have an editor or a person at an institution either tweet or write a column, in her case, talking and exhibiting institutional self-reflection about how we should do a better job of either covering issues that affect historically disadvantaged minorities or having better hiring practices or whatever. That's what started her having to take a 2-month leave, because she wrote this. Then a disgruntled freelancer said, come on, you're a hypocrite. You haven't been doing a good enough job. She kind of snapped back at her, and then the staff revolted, and boom, she's out at least for 2 months. The owner of Second City the theater in Chicago, same thing, issued some statement or a tweet saying, you know, I believe in Black Lives Matter. And then a disgruntled former employee. I know people personally who have gone through the same thing, who are not in the public, who issued an anodyne statement about in support of what's going on. And then a disgruntled former employee picks up this this weapon, wields it, and then now you're in the center of a storm. You're at the bottom of a barrel. Whatever.
Wow.
And yeah.
Matt, who's skedaddling again? I like the way you're trying to run out the clock, but come
the
on.
The center
Peter,
of the storm at the bottom of the barrel is where I always
who's
am.
Leaving? First off, who are the right wingers on the New York Times op-ed page?
I don't know.
And then, making things up in our private Slack arena.
Okay. No, look, we all hear rumors about things, and it's and we all put stuff in Slack that's just sort of like, here is a kind of thing I've heard. I reference that again specifically just to kind of characterize the general feeling that is in the air and that I think is being talked about openly. I mean, it doesn't take really difficult searches on Twitter to find people talking about, wow, are there people at the New York Times who are not going to have jobs in a month or 6 months or a year? Who maybe even have been part of the institution for a long time.
Nick, to answer your query, that wasn't a question. That was me talking. I get to talk on this podcast, too. And two, there is a query I would like to direct at you that's related,
okay,
which is SE Cup made some tweet over the weekend saying, you know, something along the line. Well, actually, you can reference it since you're the one who responded to
but
it.
But I'm old, Matt, and I've already forgotten what I tweeted over the weekend.
Basically, she said you can take a knee to protest police abuse, or you can put a knee on someone's neck. And your response was like, it doesn't have to be either or. I feel like there's been a lot of you have to do A or B, and these are the only things that are allowable to you. So before we go into what we've all been consuming, talk a little bit about why that approach to the world you think is less than required.
Well, thank you. And thank you for reminding me of what I had tweeted. You know, sometimes I go into a fugue state, Matt. I like to take Ambien at 9 a.m. and then try and stay on Ambien through about 5 p.m.
That explains some articles you've filed recently.
Oh, God, yeah. So, and a lot of stories I read just don't make any sense. I don't get it, you know.
That's how I feel about Mezcal.
Cup, you know, SE Cup, who is a good bellwether of where the center is. She had been on The Blaze. She had been on, like, Fox News and stuff like that. She'd been a right-winger. Now she's on CNN and is kind of a centrist, I would say, not even a rightist or a leftist, you know. So, you know, where she is where a lot of people are. I'm starting to really rebel against the idea that, oh, look at what has happened now. And, you know, we need to choose between A and B. We need to choose between Trump and Biden because, you know, those are the choices offered us. We really need, and this is totally in a libertarian sense and in a reason sense, like, we need to recognize that, you know, Trump and Biden are part of the same problem. And this duality of saying, oh, it's A or B. And it's like, you're either taking a knee to support Colin Kaepernick or you're kneeling on George Floyd's neck. That's the wrong way of doing it. If we think about everything in those terms, we have no alternative other than to continue down this cul-de-sac of absolute horribleness that is represented in the choice between Joe Biden and Donald Trump and so many other aspects of our culture. And, you know, I realize that, like, in the election, that doesn't leave us with anything good, you know, but we can choose to, you know, articulate and enunciate an alternative point of view, which is not based on saying, okay, you know, because the Republicans and Democrats or liberals or conservatives or what mainstream culture, you know, as envisioned or as created by the Washington Post and the New York Times and CBS and NBC, that's the limit of our choices. Screw that.
I actually,
you know, we need to start talking much more broadly. And in this particular instance, I don't know, Reason for 50 years has been talking about, like, open, you know, protest against the status quo. We're on the side of kneeling with Colin Kaepernick and pulling the cops off of George Floyd's throat. And that's a better way to look at the world. And the more people who start to kind of contemplate what we're doing and thinking about doing, and we need to do a bigger and better job of getting that out there. It's a better way. If you want to live in a world where everybody is kind of better off, everybody has freedom, and everybody can innovate and enjoy a life that's worth living, You're not going to find it trying to make a decision between A and B in a world where we don't even have to be on an alphabetic scale, a binary scale of shit and shittier.
I actually...
Peter, go ahead.
I'm going to give a little preview of my editor's note for the issue that we are closing just now, precisely because it keys off of a editor's note by Reason founder Lanny Friedlander, written in the November 1969 issue. The cover story was Cops, Heroes or Villains? And his answer is, wow, the ways that the left and the right are talking about that question are really dumb and too binary. And actually, we live in a brutally oppressive system. And we need to fix the whole system. Cops are brutal because we ask them to be brutal in order to do the jobs that we have assigned for them to do. And the only way to stop police brutality is to build a freer and more responsible society. And, you know, it's rereading this piece. One, oh my God, it's absolutely bananas. The way people wrote in the 60s is nuts. Second, he's right. He's right. He's saying the same thing Nick just said. He's saying the same thing that we say all the time. And it's that you can't always just look at the specific problem and the two sides that the mainstream parties have taken and find an answer. That's very, very often the wrong place to look for an answer. You need to ask a different question altogether.
If I can expectorate for another second or two, you know, one of the great breakthroughs of the 21st century, which is a damnable future, right, Matt? You and I are old enough to remember looking forward to the 21st century. This isn't what I was looking forward to, I suspect, you know, for the most part. I suspect you're in a similar boat. One of the great changes, though, that is a good thing, is to shift out of binary thinking and into things like gradients and putting things on a spectrum. We put everything else in our lives on a spectrum, whether it's, you know, identity, you know, ethnic identity, gender identity, sexual orientation, what kind of food we want. We want fusion food. We don't want to go from Mexican to American to Canadian cuisine, if such a thing exists, other than poutine, which is delicious. But everything is on a spectrum. Why would we insist constantly again and again in the political arena, in the ideological arena, or in the cultural arena that everything is binary? Binary is 20th century. You know, we need to get beyond binaries if we want to enjoy a 21st century that's worth a damn.
Let's go to our end of podcast, cultural consumption. Peter, why don't you start?
So I have been listening to the new Run the Jewels album, RTJ4. It is the fourth collaboration under the Run the Jewels title by Killer Mike and LP, two rappers in their mid-40s who have been kind of bumming around the rap scene for a while and gaining increasing prominence as Run the Jewels. It is an absolute banger of an album, and it is exactly the album that you wanted to listen to last week. It was supposed to come out Friday. They dropped it on Wednesday instead, and it's protest rap. It is dark, crazy, kind of schizoid, apocalyptic stuff that directly addresses police violence. There's one song that talks about a black man dying at the hands of police, saying, "I can't breathe." And then the way that sort of the Twitterati just kind of comments on it without doing anything. And they actually had to clarify that the song was written months and months and months ago, not about George Floyd, and that it was in reference to previous events. And so it is just it's a phenomenal kind of musically interesting record, but also just a really sort of perfect document of its times musically. Killer Mike is somebody who has been really interested in libertarianism for many years, a guest on Kennedy's show on occasion. He gave one of the best speeches during the moments of unrest. He lives in Atlanta and just said, look, people, if you want to organize politically, then you have to stop destroying the house that you live in. It was a really powerful moment. And so I would just recommend this album to anybody who likes really kind of crazy, you know, sort of musically interesting sonic productions, somebody who likes culturally relevant lyrics, just someone who wants the sound of the times, this is the album for you. I've also been watching Space Force on Netflix. I really didn't like it. I think Nick had a different view.
Nick, go.
Okay. I mean, I was going to go with, I rewatched V for Vendetta, the movie that was released in the spring of 2006, based on a kind of a narco comic book from scripted by Alan Moore. Watch it. It is a bizarrely relevant movie that involves a government unleashed pandemic, anarchism and overthrow of a repressive government, falseness in the media. It's kind of a great movie to be watching right now. To go back to Space Force, it's an uneven show that was both starring and co-written by Steve Carell. I enjoyed it, though, because it gives us a glimpse, Peter, of we have a Space Force. What is that going to be like? And it has some very good parodies of power at the highest levels of the American government.
So I think it's interesting that you would bring both of those up, because V for Vendetta was in many ways positioned as a critique of the Bush era and of George W. Absolutely. Bush, George W. Bush's approach to war and surveillance and sort of, you know, his kind of militaristic propaganda and all, you know, all the spy programs that we were learning about during that time.
And Space Force is a... Well, I was just going to say, and before that, the graphic novel version of V for Vendetta was seen as a critique of Thatcherite England, as everything
exactly
Alan
right.
Moore does. And it fails as both of those things.
I think of those three, I liked the Moore comic book the best, but I really didn't think that Space Force did at all a good job of critiquing the Trump administration. It sort of couldn't figure out what it was, what it stood for or what its critique was. And it's also just incredibly unfunny. It's like a laugh a season show.
Well, I think obviously I disagree somewhat. And it's what, for me, what was interesting is that it wanted to make fun of Trump and kind of Trump exclusively, who's never on camera, but it can't do that. And it ends up going after targets of wokeness as well as political correctness within the military structure and within the workplace. I think what you see among people in Carell, like Tina Fey and some older, you know, comedic geniuses, they are wrestling with the fact that, you know, they are not reactionaries by any source, and they dislike that. But they also are very uncomfortable with what's coming next, which is a really kind of itself a reactionary and very closed-minded way of thinking about the world and humor.
Catherine, what is the one cultural product that you wish to discuss?
I am reading Sarah Pinsker's A Song for a New Day. They announced the Nebula winners and this one for Best Novel. I had not heard of it, so shame on me. As soon as you look it up, though, you will realize why it won. Not only is it quite readable, but also, let me just give you very briefly the product description on Amazon. After a global pandemic makes public gatherings illegal and concerts impossible, except for those willing to break the law for the love of music and one chance at human connection, it is a book about what happens if you can't get together in a physical place due to a combination of viruses and political unrest. There is also a great kind of underground regulatory angle. There are still concerts happening. They are illegal. And most importantly, one of the main characters is a pop star whose name is, I'm not kidding you, Luce Cannon, LuceCannon. So I bring you all of that. Continuing in my theme of recommending novels about pandemics, this book was written and published in the fall of 2019, and so gets an awful lot of points for being eerily prescient, but it's also a good read.
I am 100 pages into that book, and it is fantastic.
My thing that I watched was the last two-thirds of the latest ESPN 30 for 30 Sunday night prestige attempt to follow in the wake of the Michael Jordan series that they ran. And this one was about Bruce Lee. Came out last night. The great martial artist, Hollywood icon, and premature death. It suffers from the same
premature
flaw.
Death. Assassination, Matt. Come on.
Thank you.
Vibrating
the same
palm.
Flaw that the Jordan doc does, that increasing lots of docs, including the one in between those two, which is about Lance Armstrong. I watched a couple hours of which, but like to get the participation of the characters and the family, it ends up being weirdly toothless, including in this case, referencing what Nick just talked about, like his death was like, and then he took this drug and had a brain hema something and then died. And some people say, come up with theories, but that's probably not true. That's about it. Like, dude was like as graceful and strong of an athlete as you will see. Died at age 32 in his prime. It's a little bit more mysterious than that. I don't know.
Would you agree though, Matt? I mean, I haven't watched that yet. I hope to, but you know, Bruce Lee was one of the first in an American context, a kind of international star. He expanded what it meant to be a masculine man, particularly in an American context, because he was a sexually, you know, potent Asian American. In American cinema, which hadn't existed since like Sesu Hayakawa or something back in the early silent era of Hollywood. What I love about Bruce Lee is that he was at the beginning of this great shift in America to being a more outward looking and international kind of sports and entertainment world. You know, the NASL in the 70s helped push that along by bringing in soccer players who were a rogues gallery of different types of people, different types of masculinity. Does it go into that at all?
Yes. In fact, that's a pretty, they head in a lot of that. The part that I took that I enjoyed very much, despite the documentary's shortcomings, was just simply showing how he dealt with the frustration. He'd been in Hollywood since the mid 60s and trying to make it, and had been the sidekick on the Green Hornet, but was like chewing up scenery and developing a fan base there. He had tried to become a leading guy in developing a TV show called Kung Fu, and they wouldn't give him the role because they were afraid of scaring TV audiences with Asians. They gave it to David Carradine instead. And so his family
died in Asia by his own hand, so to speak.
Yeah, who they treat very badly because people are like, and then they gave that role to that, what was his name? And they kept saying that, like two or three different people, like that what's his name guy? It's like, come on, David Carradine was pretty good there. But anyways, Bruce Lee hits, he's been trying to do this. He's trying to feed his family. It's not working. He butts up against this, the ceiling. And so what does he do? And he has this very kind of sort of philosophical, pragmatic, well, like, I got to get it done. So he goes to Hong Kong and builds his own leading man career. He roots around Hollywood and becomes such a force that Hollywood wants to bring him back now in a starring role. And that's with Enter the Dragon, which is something that Nick and I remember from our childhoods. Remarkable. And it was, it'd been a while since I remembered that Enter the Dragon came out like 11 days after he died. And it was his first big heave as a Hollywood star. And it made just a ton of money, more than $500 million adjusted to today's dollars. Anyways, but like just as a inspirational tale of I can't get this done now, I'm going to root around, create my own reality, and then you're going to have to deal with me and what I created. Was very inspirational, and also the outfits are great because it's the late 60s and early 70s. That's all of the fashion that we have time for now. Thanks for listening to the Reason Roundtable. We'll be back next week, hopefully. The pending defenestrations. Wow. Go to reason.com/podcast to get all of our great stuff there, including the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie, which comes out Wednesdays and sometimes other days too. Okay, thank you. Goodbye.